In this hour of the show, this morning, we'll be talking about what genetic science can tell us about human origins. And our guest for the program is Brian Sykes. He's professor of genetics at the Institute of Molecular Medicine at Oxford University. And he has a new book out that's titled The Seven Daughters of Eve, The Science That Reveals Our Genetic Ancestry. It's published by W.W. Norton. And in it, he talks about the ways in which, in his work, he has used genetics to answer some questions, some of them puzzling and contentious questions about how it is that human beings got to be where they are. And much of it concentrates on the origins of modern Europeans and where those people came from and in what way, if any, they are related to the older fossil humans that we have found. All of this is in the book. It's out now in bookstores if you'd like to read it. And, of course, as we talk, your questions are welcome. 333-9455. That's the number for Champaign Urbana, folks. That's where we are. But if it would be a long-distance call, use our toll-free line 800-222-9455. And at any point, you can certainly call. All we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief so we can get in as many people as possible. But anyone is welcome to call. Professor Sykes, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
We appreciate it. You start your story with the Iceman, and perhaps people will recall this story that back in 1991, there were two German climbers. They were in the Alps, and they happened upon the remains of a man. First thought maybe was a lost climber of more recent vintage. And then was determined, in fact, that this man was something like 5,000 years old. And you got involved in this because you had, in the work that you did, you had been extracting DNA from ancient bones. And apparently the question about the Iceman was, well, just exactly who is he, where did he come from, and can we make sure that that in fact he came there naturally and someone didn't do this as a sort of a modern version of the Piltdown man.
Yeah, that's right. There was a serious concern that this body, because it was so unusual, there had never been a body of that age found in the glaciers in the Alps or anywhere else, really. Reason being that glaciers just flow down the mountains, and you take about 500 years to do it. So anyone sort of fell in the ice would be coming out of the other end of the glacier within 500 years. So to find a body 5,000 years old way up in at the top of a glacier was quite extraordinary. So there was a real concern that this was actually a hoax and that a body had been helicoptered in and planted in the ice. Hmm. And the only real possibility would have been that it was a South American mummy. There are many of those which are preserved in the cold of the Andes. But the DNA that we managed to get out of the Iceman showed that actually he was a European, not a South American or from anywhere else. Mm-hmm. So that showed it really was a genuine find. But when I was asked, well, how do we know it was a European, the reason was that it had the DNA that we got from the Iceman was very similar, in fact identical, to DNA that we find in modern Europeans. Mm-hmm. But one of the journalists from the London Sunday Times pressed me a bit further on that, said, well, who are these modern Europeans? What are their names? Who are they? And, of course, I didn't tell them because this is all very confidential information. All our volunteers that helped us in this research program, their names are kept entirely confidential. Mm-hmm. However, I did have a look, and I saw that one of them was a friend of mine, and she'd given me some of her hair a few years before to extract DNA from, and I thought, well, she may not mind having herself her name revealed to the Sunday Times. I rang her, and she didn't mind. And so what happened then was that the interest of the story sort of moved away from the scientific part of it and the extraction of the DNA from the Iceman showing it was genuine to this link. And the wonderful, there's a wonderful headline in the Sunday Times. She and my friend live in Bournemouth in southern England, and the headline read, "Iceman's relative found in Dorset." And the really strange thing about it was that once she realized that she had the same DNA and therefore was connected, in a real sense, as a relative of the Iceman, she actually began to feel something for him in the sense of in not being a bit concerned that he was being moved around from forensic labs and bits of samples cut off him and taken away for analysis, everything. Mm-hmm. So she really made a real, not just a, well, she made a real sort of emotional connection with him. And that's something which has been repeated time and time again, and I've noticed and seen this, observed it in the work over succeeding years.
They're even better than the headline, Iceman's Relative Found in Dorset, was the one in the Irish Times.
Oh, yeah.
Where they, see, it's a great story. Is that the reporter actually asked this woman, well, your ancient relative, did he leave you anything? In the ways of inheritance. And of course she said, well, no. And then the headline appeared, Iceman leaves one of our own destitute in Bournemouth.
That's right. Brilliant, wasn't it?
It's great. It's really wonderful. You just can't make, really, you can't make stuff up like that. The truth is always sort of stranger than fiction.
The whole of the book is full of odd things and accidents and the way things actually happened. I mean, anyone who thinks science is a smooth progression from one theory to another one is, we'll see that in fact it's anything but that. Mm.
Well, what you were able to do, because you had this, had accumulated this DNA database of living Europeans, you could say that here we could pick at least one person, this one person that we know is indeed a distant relative, but a relative of this man. How is it possible to put a ballpark sort of estimate on, in fact, how many of this man's descendants there might be now living?
Yeah. Perhaps I ought to say a bit about the actual gene, the DNA that we use, because it is a very special one.
Mm-hmm.
It's one that's called mitochondrial DNA, long word, but abbreviated perfectly well to mDNA. And mDNA is inherited only through the maternal line. So everybody gets their mDNA from their mothers. Men and women have it, but men don't pass it on. Only women do. So you, for example, David, you had your mDNA from your mother, who'd have got it from her mother, and so on, way back in a linear link right back into the deep past. So when I say that my friend Mari was a relative of the Iceman, it's through this very special maternal link. She wouldn't be a direct descendant of the Iceman because, being a man, he wouldn't pass on his mDNA. But he's related to one of the Iceman's, through one of the Iceman's relatives. They share, if you like, a common ancestor. And that was when we did that work in about 1994. After that, we've spent a lot of time just trying to link up as many people as we could in Europe and in other parts of the world. But the book, as you said, is largely about Europe, really, because I've done most of my work in Europe. The same basic principles apply anywhere in the world, in that you can group modern living people into separate clusters, if you like, where they have this maternal relationship, which you can define by the DNA. And although these clusters are themselves related, and the book shows how that's done, within the clusters, everyone is descended from one original woman, who, if I call them the clan mothers, the people that started off the cluster.
Mm.
And in the case of the Iceman, they belong to the cluster of the seven daughters of Eve, I should say, are the seven clan mothers of the seven clans that are found in Europe, and they have names. I've given them names. And the daughters of Katrine, the clan mother of the Iceman, and Mari, are all related in that special maternal way back to one woman, Katrine, who lived about 15,000 years ago, I've estimated, in northern Italy, not all that far from where the Iceman himself was found.
Perhaps at this point I should introduce again our guest for anyone who has tuned in just recently. We're speaking with Brian Sykes. He's professor of genetics at the Institute of Molecular Medicine at Oxford University. And the book we're talking about, if you'd like to read it, is titled The Seven Daughters of Eve, The Science That Reveals Our Genetic Ancestry. It's published by W.W. Norton and is out in bookstores now. And questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. Just for a second to go back over the this business about mitochondrial DNA, just to eliminate any confusion, people understand basically the idea that there is this stuff that's called DNA that is the recipe for us, and that when people make babies, the baby is a result of the combination of that DNA of both parents. But here they were talking about some the DNA that is in a different structure in the cell, not in the nucleus, but in the cell. And this is the mitochondria, and this is the stuff that only comes from our mothers. We apparently know that this DNA changes spontaneously over time, changes faster than the DNA in the nucleus does. And that because we know that rate of change, we can use it like a clock and, in fact, run it backwards to arrive at the starting point for our species, Homo sapiens. I sort of got all that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It's very well put, yes. You can run the clock back to determine, for example, the age of the clan mothers in all these seven clusters in Europe or anywhere else, and then combine the whole of the human race, everyone that's alive on the planet now, run the clock back there, and you eventually come back to just one woman. She's been called Mitochondrial Eve, and she lived in Africa, and running the clock backwards, you can put a date on that at about 150 to 200,000 years ago. And so she is the only woman alive at that time who has maternal descendants still surviving today. There were other women alive and around about that then, of course, but they haven't got continual maternal descendants, continual maternal lineages stretching through right to the present day, because either they didn't have children or they had sons not passing on mitochondrial DNA in the intervening period somewhere along the line.
So that's how we arrive at this data that says our species, Homo sapiens, modern human beings, originated in Africa, we think, about 150,000 years ago. And from there, all living people on this planet now ultimately come.
Yes, that's right. It wouldn't be true to say that that Eve was the ancestor, the common ancestor for all of our genes, just this one. There would have been other humans around at the time, around about that time, who would be the ancestor of the other genes. But certainly something very unusual happened about that time, and that is when we normally think of our human species beginning to become Homo sapiens and then spreading from Africa, out of Africa into Eurasia and eventually into America and the Polynesian Islands, New Zealand and so on, from that very early beginning. However, having said that, it's not all that long ago. 150, 200,000 years is a very short time for species, and it really supported very strongly a paleontological argument based on fossils and how they looked, that modern humans, Homo sapiens, had a recent relatively recently come out of Africa, so that other hominids like Homo erectus and Neanderthals, which have been found outside of Africa much longer ago, up to 2 million years ago, and who were once thought indeed to be our ancestors, this new genetic evidence really shows that that isn't the case, that these other species like Neanderthals and Homo erectus actually were other types of human that became extinct.
We have a couple of callers to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. We will start with Bloomington, Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Hi, Professor Sykes. I think there's a question about this date that you have given of human origins, between 100 and 200,000 years ago.
Yeah.
According to the mitochondrial DNA analysis, you may want to comment on the different types of chemical analysis that are available now, but as I understand, there are four types. Mitochondrial DNA analysis is only one of them, The other three are Y chromosomal analysis. That goes as mitochondrial DNA analysis traces the ancestry through women.
Uh-huh.
Y chromosome analysis traces it through men. You also have genetic diversity analysis, and finally, linkage disequilibrium analysis. And all four of these analyses, as I understand, establish the origin of man from, as you say, Eve, a mitochondrial Eve. As the literature I read says, from a very small population. But the dates that the literature I have access to says, probably that this human origin, started not more than 50,000 years ago. So you're saying between 100 and 200,000 years ago. This data is saying probably not more than 50,000 years ago, and certainly less than 100,000 years ago.
Well, what you're talking about there is there's Y chromosome DNA, which follows a paternal line.
Right.
And the aging of that, the way in which you work out the mutation rate in Y chromosomal DNA, is still slightly uncertain. The point is that they're all coming out with quite recent dates.
Yes.
These dates are not fixed in stone. They have wide confidence intervals, especially the ones where you're looking at what you refer to as linkage disequilibrium, which is where you try and see where the nuclear chromosomes, they get mixed up at every generation. You try and see how much mixing has occurred.
Right.
So the fact that they're hovering around the sort of 100,000 year mark is sufficiently good, really, to support the idea of a much more recent emergence of Homo sapiens from Africa than the other main theory.
In other words, we can agree that that the emergence of humans is more recent than we had thought it was.
Well, I certainly wouldn't think that I would think 50,000 years. I've seen these. You go back, the last 10 years and look at the dates that have been put forward from all sorts of analysis. They're all coming out around about the sort of 150,000. Now, you're referring to some recent claims from Y chromosomes that it's less than that.
Yes.
I would find that very difficult to believe that it was the Homo sapiens much less than that, because the anatomically modern form of humans has been found in the Middle East and in Africa at least 100,000 years ago.
Well, I want to ask you a question about that, too.
That's in the fossil record.
Mm. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, now, about the fossil record.
Yes.
When we compare fossil structures where you have bone structure that is similar, for instance, evolutionists have declared that the bone structure of certain apes is similar to the bone structure of humans, and therefore they conclude that the apes and humans must have had a common ancestor.
Yes.
But when they check the chemical, genetic, you know, the type of similarities, the type of genetic checks that you're talking about today, and when they check the chemical similarities between these bones, they don't match. In other words, the evolutionists conclude from the fossil evidence that the bones had a common ancestor. But when they check the chemical genetic evidence, the bones don't match.
Well, I'm not sure I agree with that, really. If you look at the similarities in genes, not just mitochondria, but in the nuclear genes, the great majority of genes, there are great similarities between humans and the other primates. For example, of all the other species living on the planet, the one that has the closest genetic signature, the closest sequence to our own, is certainly that of the chimpanzee. And so it's reasonable, I think, to conclude that the reason for that is that both humans, Homo sapiens, and chimpanzees did have a common ancestor way back, and I'm probably something like 4 to 6 million years ago, and that they have changed since they've been separated, which has accounted for the present-day differences between their DNA. But we're certainly much closer to chimpanzees, actually, even than gorillas or orangutans, the other large primate. But I wouldn't agree with you that the molecular, the genetic evidence has argued against what was already put forward from the fossil evidence, that our closest relatives in the animal kingdom are the great apes, and that we once had a common ancestor.
I must jump in here. I hope the caller forgive me. He might like to go on, but we're already at our midpoint. I have two other people holding and would like to continue to get some other people here into the program. And probably I should also introduce again our guest. We're speaking with Brian Sykes. He's professor of genetics at the Institute of Molecular Medicine at Oxford University. And has authored a book on this subject, if you'd like to read it. It's just out. It's titled The Seven Daughters of Eve, The Science That Reveals Our Genetic Ancestry. That's the subtitle, and it's published by W.W. Norton. Your questions welcome with 333-WILL or 9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana listeners. Toll-free, 800-222-WILL. We'll go next to a caller in Champaign. This would be line one. Hello.
Thank you. Yeah, I missed the very first part of the program, so maybe you explain this, but I'm curious to know just how the rate of change in mitochondrion DNA has been established. I mean, how do you know so clearly that it changes at the rate it does?
Well, that's a very, very central question, really. The original way it was done was actually going back to the last caller's question, was to compare the mitochondrial DNA in modern humans with that in chimpanzees and assume from the fossil record that they had a common ancestor 4 to 6 million years ago and then just work it out on that basis. I mean, that's a terribly, terribly rough way of doing it, but that's how people, that's the figure that people first used. And funnily enough, it turns out to be quite a good figure because it's been confirmed by other analysis just using humans. Two different things. First of all, looking at somewhere that you know was uninhabited until a certain set date, and the best example of that is the islands of Polynesia, where you know that they were first colonized, places like Samoa and Tonga, about 3,000 years ago. And you can look at the mitochondrial DNA, and I have done, and it's in the book, and see how much change has accumulated within that 3,000 years, then running the clock back, work out at what rate it's happening. The other way to do it is to look directly at families, pedigrees, and you can observe the mutations as they happen. And you have to do a lot of work for this, but we've found in a very large study that about 1.5% of modern humans have two, not just one, but two sorts of mitochondria in their body cells. If you like, an original one plus another one that has slightly changed because of one of these mutations. And you can follow these through pedigrees and see how long they take to sort themselves out. It's a complex way of doing it, but it's an independent and direct measure of the mutation rate. And strange enough, both of those methods, the direct method and the one in Polynesia, and there have been equivalent studies done in other parts of the world, all come down to pretty much the same mutation rate that we were already using based on the human-chimp divergence.
And what would you say is the effect on the genetic change? And I've heard that, you know, we're so incredibly similar because of what's called the bottleneck that's happened about somewhere a little over 70,000 years ago. And theorizing that it was a result of a massive volcanic eruption that you know, sort of limited the population so that there were just a very few humans left in Africa and possibly any place else they were got wiped out.
Well, it's certainly true that the relatively recent time for human evolution let's say 150,000 or something like that, it means that we start off with quite a small population. Now, there are always stories about catastrophes, as the one, for example, that you're referring to, where there's a bottleneck, 60, 70,000 years ago. But I'm not really convinced about this. These are all, one would need to have very much more direct evidence that there was indeed a volcanic eruption then and that there were not only humans suffered but other animals as well. And really these are deductions from quite complex models of population growth, statistical models looking at the way in which mutations are affected by the range of mutations is affected by the sizes of populations, and they're very, very hard, very very new and very difficult statistical methods to try and discover this. So I don't think that the populations are always sort of going up and going down, expanding, contracting. I'm not convinced that there is any evidence of one really big dramatic bottleneck at that time. In other words, that there were hundreds of millions of humans living before that, then it suddenly shrunk to about 10,000 or something of that order. There certainly were times when populations would increase and decrease, just as they do in many native species of animals, plants and everything else. But I can't see any very convincing evidence that there was one single bottleneck which explains why we're all so recently evolved. I think the fact of the matter is we just are recently evolved. Of course, not very many people actually got out of Africa, emerged from Africa, to populate the rest of the world. So in a sense, that's a sort of bottleneck. And you can see that signature quite clearly in the genetics as well.
All right. Well, thank you.
All right. To another caller here, this will be Urbana, and it's line two. Hello.
Yeah, I've got a few questions I'd like to ask. I don't understand where the how do you get the geographic info? It's like I read that one of the seven daughters you're speaking of was Basque, you think she was Basque, and I'm just
well, she wasn't Basque because there were no such things as Basques in those days. But I know what you mean. I have given an estimate of where I think these women lived. And the way I've done that is twofold. First of all, the first thing is to work out how long ago they lived, and I think we've covered that adequately by looking at the mutation accumulations. So, obviously, they can only have lived in places that were habitable at that time. So, take take for example Helena, which is one of the, well, it is the largest of the clans. The Helena in that case lived 20,000 years ago. There's plenty of Helena, for example, in northern Scotland, but that couldn't be where she started because that was covered in ice at the time. So they had to be places where people were living. Let's take that example you mentioned of Velda, and I've put her in northern Spain. And the reason is, first of all, that if you look, it's really done from the contemporary distribution of the clan, but not just in the sense of how many how common is the clan in a different in a particular area, but also how diverse it is. So in case of Velda, although it's pretty common in northern Spain, it's also quite common elsewhere. It's interesting enough amongst the Sami of Finland, for example, northern Finland. But what's also very obvious from the Spanish clan of Velda, there's a lot of people in the clan in Spain, and they have very many differences within them, which means that the clan has been there longer in Spain to accumulate their differences than it has been, for example, amongst the Sami, where the Sami have got quite a lot of descendants of Velda, but their mitochondria is very similar to one another. So it's only been there relatively recently. So it's that combination of looking where it's frequent, but also importantly looking where the diversity is high that has placed where I've given those estimates to whereabouts they lived.
Wow, that's very interesting. Another question is, I read that they had made the lifespan of a nematode much greater using. Reducing the oxygen radicals, and that mitochondria and DNA is involved in the production of oxygen radicals, which brings up the question: is there any obvious, or do you think there might possibly be an advantage between one clan's form of mDNA and another?
Well, that's a very interesting point, really. I don't think it will actually matter very much what a man's mitochondrial DNA is like. It only really matters what a woman's is like, because the man's not going to get passed on. But certainly, mitochondria, they're the sort of energy power stations of the cell, and they do produce oxygen radicals, and that's probably why, actually, the mitochondrial DNA changes much more quickly than the DNA in the nucleus. So There's something very curious. We talked about Helena. It's about 40% of modern Europeans track back to Helena, a very, very large clan. And it is curious. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if there was some slight advantage, or had been in the past, to the mitochondrial performance of people in that clan. And I'm doing research on all sorts of different parameters, sports ability and things connected with metabolism and so on, just to see if there is any correlation between performance and mitochondrial structure, mitochondrial clan, if you like. But that work's not yet ready.
Yeah. And final question, which is kind of related. I understand that that there's some fear that racists people with racist ideas may try to take advantage of this, and I don't know whether you know whether they're right about that or not. But I have read that
they're completely wrong about that. Really, I mean, one of the very strong messages from this kind of work and from the book is that there really is no genetic basis for any sort of racial purity, because the you can see that in. Take Europe. Any country in Europe, any group in Europe, there are always representatives of all of the seven clusters that have been found. So there's no population in Europe which you can say is all Helena or all Velda or anything like that. There's mixture, and it's just reflecting what has been the pattern of human evolution over thousands of years. Tens of thousands of years, which is that populations haven't done anything on their own. It's just a big question of individuals moving. And these patterns were laid down way before the more recent arrival of definitions about ethnicity and racial groups. So I know I've seen that certain political movements are saying this kind of work supports their ideas of racial purity, but it's completely the opposite. It completely destroys those ideas.
That's not true for what's been found in the Indian subcontinent, is it? Because I understood that the upper caste there had more European roots with this kind of analysis, and the lower caste had more Asian roots. So there it would seem to, you know, give them fodder for their...
Yes, but I'm not sure about that. I'm not familiar with that. I think I know the piece of work you're referring to, but I'm not very familiar with it. But what it means is you're still making these population comparisons. You can't do that, really. The idea of having a population or racial group as a genetic entity is a very old-fashioned one. It actually arose because the only way you could do population genetics in the past was by comparing one group with another. You could compare the frequency of blood groups or other things like that, one with another. But you don't need to do that anymore. You can do it using these individual lineages. And as soon as you start to do that, you realize that these groups have no real meaning whatsoever, and that the history of the world is all about individuals. There are identical mitochondria, mitochondrial DNA, in any sort of groups that you try to construct in the Indian subcontinent or anywhere else. So there's absolutely no reason to use this rather old-fashioned and outdated way of looking at human population genetics at all. You can do it all on the individual level. And that's the great thing about this, because what it's showing is that our DNA and all of our genes, but exemplified by mitochondrial DNA, have come to us from individual ancestors over thousands of years and traveling through over thousands of miles just to get to us. We should be very proud of our genes, and they're not there just because of the population to which we belong.
Very good. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. About 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. And again, our guest is Brian Sykes. He is a geneticist. He's a professor of genetics at the Institute of Molecular Medicine at Oxford and is the author of this book that explains all of this in greater detail if you'd like to read it, The Seven Daughters of Eve, published by W.W. Norton. Questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. As we explained a little bit earlier, the work that you have done has provided some answers to some fairly long-standing questions about origins. One that we touched on was the question of the relationship, or whether there is relationship between us, between Homo sapiens and the Neanderthals, for example, the older fossil evidence remains that we have. And the answer that DNA, the mitochondrial DNA provides is no, we are, modern Europeans are not descended from Neanderthals. There was also another question, though, that had to do with the what we thought was the pattern of spread of humans in Europe. And there, I gather that the prevailing idea, at least had been, the theory had been that primitive hunter-gatherers, the Cro-Magnons, had come along and they had replaced the Neanderthals. But then some other people had come along who were farmers, probably people who came from the Near East, and that they had come in then later and had replaced these hunter-gatherers. And that was the idea that I guess had been prevailing within the anthropology community. And your work really challenged that notion and said, no, that's actually not the way that it happened.
That's right. Yeah, that's absolutely right. We did. On the first point about the Neanderthals, certainly we've never found any DNA in modern Europeans that we could creditably say was Neanderthal. So that's the reason that we've said that there wasn't that Neanderthals did go extinct, and there was no interbreeding with Cro-Magnons, modern humans, and Neanderthals. Mm-hmm. At least we haven't found any evidence. I can't say there's none, but we've not found any evidence of Neanderthal genes in the modern population. Of course, this contradicts what a lot of people think, and we get all sorts of letters saying, "Well, no, what are you talking about? I know somebody who's exactly like a Neanderthal." Get that all the time. No, the other point, and that's actually one of the features of the research in this area over the last 5 years. You're quite right. The prevailing idea amongst anthropologists over sort of the last 50,000 years of European prehistory was that the hunter-gatherers were more or less replaced and overwhelmed, really, by incoming agriculturalists, incoming farmers from the Near East. Now, when we did these time estimates, we found that 6 out of the 7 clans were much older in Europe than agriculture was. And that's really the basis of our disagreement with this prevailing opinion. And we've spent the last 4 or 5 years trying to prove or to back up our assertion that actually most of the mitochondrial genes, certainly, in modern Europeans, do predate the arrival of agriculture. In other words, that something like 80-85% of mitochondrial DNA amongst native Europeans originated from hunter-gatherers. Now, actually, the debate has gone to and fro, but I think now that most people probably agree with us, because there's backup from the Y chromosome recently to show that they too date back before the arrival of agriculture. So the debate is certainly swinging in our direction at the moment. But like all these things, any moment you could have contradicting evidence. That's just how science works. Mm-hmm. But the debate, I think, has been carried on very, very fairly. It's perfectly right that we should have to make our case very strongly and back them up with looking very closely at the mutation rate and other things. But we've done that, and the conclusion still stands that most of our ancestors, our mitochondrial ancestors, and probably all of our ancestors in Europe were in Europe before the arrival of the farmers. Mm-hmm. So we've got a lot of hunter-gatherer genes within us, more than perhaps we realized. Mm.
And just to, real quick, unfortunately, we only have about maybe 5 minutes left, but so people sort of understand the idea of the seven daughters. What you did as part of your work was gathered samples from thousands of living Europeans, and what you found when you looked at them basically is that you found sequences in many of them that either were the same or were close enough to say that they're the same, and that they grouped into seven groups. And from there comes this idea that, well, really what we're talking about here is that almost all modern native Europeans fit into one of these seven groups, and that means that they are descended from one of these seven sort of prototype women's, these clan mothers, and you have given them names and imagined where they would have lived when they, and it's not a matter of imagination when, but sort of imagined who they were and how they lived, and that's what the title, The Seven Daughters of Eve,
right,
is all about.
Yeah, this is, I mean, as you say, there's seven groups. They must have started by one woman. I've given them names, and that was a device to really bring them to life.
Mm.
I think about, you know, what was this woman like that I'm descended from? What was her daily life like? She was successful. She had children. She had to survive in very, very harsh conditions. And the section of the book does imagine what the life of each of these seven women was like. That's informed by the archaeology, what was known about the diet at the time, what about the animals were like, what the climate was like. Because the thrust of all of this genetics and the thrust of the book is to emphasize the fact that our ancestors were individuals and they had daily lives. I think they're so genetically similar to us. Many of their emotions and their feelings about the world and each other must have been very similar. I can't imagine that much of that is such a recent adaptation. And so those imagined lives are in there really to reinforce the idea that our genes have come down through lines of individuals, not through some hazy sort of population idea.
Mm.
And one of the most interesting sort of follow-ons from this is that when articles about this appeared in the press, we literally had hundreds of people asking us if we could say, well, which of these seven women, their names are Helena and Xenia, Ursula, Katrine, Tara and Jasmine and Velda, which of these women they themselves were descended from. And so much so that the university in Oxford has set up a website, which is www.oxfordancestors, that's all one word, .com, to handle this demand. And it's doing this for hundreds of people every week. And why is that? What is it? What's the reason? What motivates people to do that? And it's really, I think, a sense of connection. And I've seen this. I observed it with Mar in The Iceman, but with living people, if they find out they are actually in the same clan, thus they are related to this very, very special maternal connection that connects people, that connects mothers to their children, the cycle of love and pain and nurture, they definitely feel very much closer to one another.
Hmm.
And it's a kind of rooting of a feeling of connections going back into the deep past, which many people these days feel they don't have, really, but they do. It's in every cell of their body. The whole of human history of the human species is carried in the cells of our own bodies and links us back to these people, our ancestors, way back thousands of years ago.
Right.
And it's there. It's being carried around with us now. It's not a record that's going to fade, and it's not written on parchment or on stone or will or won't wear out. It's actually in ourselves. It's a remarkable, remarkable feeling.
Yeah. Well, I think it's fascinating that people should feel that connection, and perhaps it's not surprising. It's something that we would be curious about. Much older human remains, you know, how can you really relate to Neanderthal or Homo erectus or something like that when we see these old either pictures of them or we go to the museums and we see them? You can't really, the idea that person is related to you, might be related to you even distantly, is sort of hard to grab
onto.
It
doesn't mean very much, does it?
Yeah.
It doesn't hit you.
Yeah.
But when you find out, when you realize where your DNA has come from, it really does hit you. And you know, if you have had that done, you'd feel the same way, really. It really makes all the difference. It really does.
Well, I want to say, Professor Sykes, thank you very much for giving us some of your time and talking about the book. We appreciate it.
Oh, great pleasure.
Our guest, Brian Sykes, he's professor of genetics at the Institute of Molecular Medicine at Oxford University. And this book that we have been talking about, once again, the title is The Seven Daughters of Eve, The Science That Reveals Our Genetic Ancestry. It is published by W.W. Norton and should be out and available in the bookstore right now.